Make career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. ANWR, that's A-N-W-R, four little letters, pregnant with political difficulties. To some, ANWR means oil. To others, it means pristine wilderness. And to all involved, it's poised to become the most contested piece of real estate in the country. Today, we're going 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle to a 1.5 million acre stretch of coastal plain in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where winter hangs around for 9 months, but where humans and sunlight have only fleeting stays. Depending on whom you ask, that land, which is roughly twice the size of Rhode Island, is either the biological heart of the entire South Carolina-sized 19 million acre refuge, or it's our best option for reducing our dependency on foreign oil. Connection listeners, what's at stake here? The last unspoiled habitats of porcupine, caribou, and muskoxen? Or the chance to help America kick its foreign oil habit? We're barreling across the tundra on The Connection today, and we want you to join us. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call to join us in the ANWR Connection. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start the show with two guests on the line from Alaska. Debbie Miller, the author of Midnight Wilderness, Journeys in Alaska's National Wildlife Refuge, and Lon Satsala, mayor of Kaktovik, a 260-resident island directly north of ANWR off the coast of Alaska. And then joining us later in the hour will be Ken Bird, the project chief of the Alaska Petroleum Studies Project for the U.S. Geological Survey, and we'll have Richard Kennelly, Energy Projects Director at the Conservation Law Foundation in Boston, and Roger Herrera, we have a lot of guests today, D.C. Coordinator for the Arctic Power in Washington, D.C. Debbie Miller, let's start with you up in Fairbanks, Alaska. Paint us a picture, if you will. Tell us what this place looks like.
Well, good morning. I've lived in Alaska for 25 years, and nearly every summer our family has journeyed to the Arctic Refuge. And each time I return to this place, I'm awestruck by the beauty, by the magnificence of the coastal plain, the mountains that border this region. We have wildlife spectacles along the coastal plain that you no longer can see anywhere else in America. I've stood out on the tundra and watched 40,000 caribou encircle me. I've seen birds from four different continents that come to nest here every summer, tundra swans that make their journey from Chesapeake Bay and the Carolinas, or the snow geese that come from Central California. It's a tremendous area for wildlife during the summer months.
Tell me what the landscape itself looks like. As I understand it, the 1.5 million acres that are in question here, that's a small portion of the whole refuge. That 1.5 acres has the range of mountains right up next to the coastline, so there's a narrow band of tundra between the mountains and the coastline. Is that accurate? Tell me what that looks like.
That's accurate. And actually, this, to paint the picture, the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge is quite different than the rest of the North Slope of Alaska. This is a very narrow band of coastal plain. It averages about 25 miles in width, and it's wedged between the Arctic Ocean and the highest, most beautiful mountains of the Brooks Range. These are 9,000-foot peaks, and if you're standing on top of one of these mountains, you look out across this treeless, open, vast plain, and then beyond to the Arctic Ocean. It's a beautiful vista, and you have the feeling that you can see forever when you're out there because the land is treeless.
People, this is not a tourism center, I take it. People don't go up there in droves to take a look at what's going on. What's it like to live up there? I mean, do people? Nobody lives there, right? In this area that we're
talking
about.
Well, this is a wildlife refuge, and you do have the village of Kaktovik with the Inupiaq residents that have hunted and fished on those lands for years to come. On the southern boundary of the Arctic Refuge, you have the Gwich'in village of Arctic Village, and there are many neighboring Indian villages that rely on the porcupine caribou herd that actually they calve on the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. They've done this for thousands of years. They've traveled there to give birth to as many as 40 to 50,000 calves, if you can imagine. I've been up there and witnessed this. When one day you go out on the tundra and you might see 100,000 pregnant cow caribou, and then a few days later, the whole tundra is flooded with new life, 50,000 calves. Now, this herd is very important.
They must be noisy.
They're very noisy. They grunt, they snort, they bellow, they bleat. I call it a caribou symphony. When you're out on the tundra and you witness this, this is something like the wildebeest in Africa. We don't have the buffalo on the Great Plains anymore. But in Alaska, we still have these wandering caribou herds. Now, the porcupine herd is one of the largest caribou herds we have in North America, and it is the largest international caribou herd that we have. We share this herd with Canada, and the Canadians are vehemently opposed to development in this area. The Gwich'in Indian people are opposed because the coastal plain is sacred ground. This is where the herd gives birth, and the Gwich'in Indians and on the southern side of the Brooks Range, they've hunted this herd for as long as some people think 10,000 or more years.
I'm not going to ask you right this minute why they're called porcupine caribou, although that does intrigue me. But first, I want to go to Lon Sansala. He's the mayor of Kaktovik, which is a village of 260 people, directly north of Anwar, off the coast of Alaska. Lon, as I understand it, you're a supporter of drilling in the refuge. Why is that?
Well, the people here have seen what has happened in Prudhoe Bay, and they are comfortable with the development that can occur without affecting the wildlife.
And Prudhoe Bay is another area where we've already been drilling for some time. It was controversial at the time, but we've got the Alaska National Pipeline running, and we have drilling there, right?
Right. And the people that lived here before the pipeline were concerned that the wildlife would be affected when the pipeline and the drilling and all the oil-related activities would occur at Prudhoe Bay. But what we've seen is that the wildlife are comfortable mingling in and around all the oil activity. They're not drastically affected by the inanimate objects that are on the ground.
Give us a little idea of what your village looks like. What's the landscape surrounding you? Is it as beautiful as Debbie described that part of the refuge she was talking about?
Well, I think she was describing the summertime vistas. Most of the year, we're looking at a white flatness. And like today, it's 3 below and 15 mile an hour wind, which is actually a pretty nice day here. And there's just a lot of white, and actually the between the ocean and the mountains, it's probably where we're at in ways is 45 to 50 miles. So it is a little bit wider. And what I'd like to stress is that the people here are environmentalists, and we do care about the caribou as much as anyone else.
Does your village depend upon the caribou and other wildlife there for its living in any way? I mean, are you still hunting these animals?
We do hunt them, but the thing is that the porcupine herd is only here in Anwar for a very short period of time. They come in sometime in May, and they drop their calves. And as soon as the calves are ready to move, they are heading back to Canada. And so basically, there's a very short period of time that the caribou are accessible to us. And we don't do any hunting of the caribou during calving season. And we've also stressed that if there was any development in Anwar, there would be no oil activities that would make any kind of noise or stress the calving during calving season, because that's very important to us, too.
If this drilling should occur up there and the oil industry comes there, would there be jobs for people in your village? Is that something that you're looking forward to?
There should be extra jobs, yes. But there should be also other benefits that we should help the local people here. Because you know, we live here and people have lived here for thousands of years and have hunted the caribou and the sheep. And possibly one of the benefits would be that we firmly believe that we're probably sitting on a large stockpile of natural gas. And at this point, we get our home heating fuel shipped up from the lower 48. And so that would be a benefit to the local people here to have heat and electricity and the cooking available with a cheaper source of energy that we're sitting right on top of anyways, probably.
1-800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. We're talking with Debbie Miller, who's up in Fairbanks, and she is opposed to drilling in the Anwar, and also Lon Sensala, who's the mayor of Kaktovik, a village off the coast on an island in northern Alaska. George, you're on the line. You're on the connection. Welcome.
How do. I'd like to inject a little historical perspective into this whole thing. M. King Hubbard of the U.S. Geological Survey won a bet by predicting when the peak of U.S. oil production would be reached, and that was in the early 70s. So even if Anwar is open, my understanding is that we will still not be producing at the peak level. We're already on the downside of the curve. A friend of mine by the name of Richard Duncan has used expanded M. King Hubbard's work and predicted the peak of world oil production to be sometime within the next 5 to 10 years, and also about the same time politically things are going to change, because the majority of world oil production will then be in the hands of Islamic states, which leads to some political problems. If you remember when Prudhoe Bay was opened up to oil exploration, the Congress said that we should only use this oil for domestic consumption, and then 10-15 years ago they went back on that promise, and now a great proportion, if not the majority, of the oil goes to Japan.
George, I'm going to cut you off here slightly. I think you've made some good points, and I want to hear from Debbie Miller up very briefly. Debbie.
Yeah, well, I would have to say I think he's in the right direction there. This will not solve our energy crisis, if you want to call it a crisis. Even Department of Energy in 2000, they're projecting that if there is oil under the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, that the mean production of what would come out of this area would be about 500,000 barrels a day. Now, we use close to 20 million barrels a day. So we're talking about maybe 2-3% of what we use every day in America, at best.
Lon Sensala, you've got a very brief chance here to get your last word in from Kaktovik.
Well, nobody says that this will be a cure-all for the country's energy woes, but my main point is that if anything happens here one way or the other, the people that live here and occupy the coastal plain need to be consulted, because this is our land, and we've been using it for a long time. And so.
Does everybody in the village, Lon, support your position?
Not everybody, but just about everybody. It's a majority of people, about 75%.
We're going to be coming back to the issue of how much oil is there, how much we need, later in the program. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio, 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm John McChesney.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Fornova.
You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. You can join our conversation about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. It's actually the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where President Bush would like to do some drilling for oil. You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're going to talk now with Ken Bird. He's the project chief of the Alaska Petroleum Studies Project for the U.S. Geological Survey. Ken, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, and good morning.
What do we know about how much oil there is up there in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge?
Finding out how much oil is actually there is is something that you really have to drill in order to find. But we can make estimates of how much is there, and we've done that by analyzing the surrounding geology, looking at seismic information that gives us some look at what is beneath the coastal plain, what the rocks look like, and from nearby drilling, and by combining all of this information, we can come up with a set of estimates of how much oil is actually there.
How do we make those estimates these days? I mean, what kind of technology are we using up there to find out what kind of reserves are there?
What you do is you look at the various factors that go into actually making an oil or gas accumulation. And so you look at the rocks. You look to see if there's enough organic matter in the rocks to generate oil or gas. You look at something that would tell you about the temperature history of the rocks, whether they've been heated enough to generate the oil. You want to know something about whether the rocks have porosity, which would hold the oil or gas. And finally, you look for structural features that would trap the oil and gas underground. You look for domal shaped features, and seismic information is probably one of the most critical pieces of information that you have in this area. It allows you to see the structure of the rocks underground.
You can actually create a three-dimensional image of the subsurface earth, right?
And that's correct. If you have closely spaced seismic lines, you can actually create a three-dimensional image.
Is this oil going to be as easy to extract as the oil we get now from Prudhoe Bay and pump down the Alaska National Pipeline?
It's a little hard to say. We don't think that there's a nice reservoir very much like Prudhoe Bay. We don't think that's likely to occur in the wildlife refuge. But we do think there are significant younger reservoirs that do have good characteristics, and that they would produce at rates probably comparable to what's being produced at Prudhoe Bay.
Ken, a lot of people use your numbers, and they use them in different ways. Does it trouble you that what you're trying to do is objective scientific information gets politicized?
Well, we're used to that, but we do provide a range of numbers because there is uncertainty in these estimates that we make, and we try to characterize that uncertainty by providing this range of numbers, and we attach probabilities to these numbers, and that's where things tend to get out of hand. People tend to ignore the probabilities that are attached and just pick their favorite number.
Ken Barrett of the U.S. Geological Survey, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Connection, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, and oil drilling there. In our studios today, we have Richard Kennelly, who's the Energy Projects Director at the Conservation Law Foundation in Boston. Richard, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Is it unusual for private enterprise, private drilling, to be engaged in drilling on public lands, of making money from public lands? Is that unusual? It's not, is it?
Well, certainly we have a long history of using our private lands, essentially that belong to the people of the United States, for all kinds of extraction, mining, grazing, and so on, which rarely inures back, the benefit rarely inures back to the people.
Mm-hmm. I take it that your organization is not exactly backing this effort to get drilling going up there. What kind of impact do you think the drilling will have on the wilderness area there?
The impact is likely to be severe. As we heard earlier in the program, this is a very narrow stretch north of the Brooks Range where the land slopes down to the coast, and it's only 10 to 40 miles wide. So it's a narrow stretch, and because of that change in altitude, you get a very quite a variety of habitat and therefore a lot of species. Now, you combine that with the fact that unlike Prudhoe Bay, where the oil is in one large reserve, this is in lots of smaller reserves scattered around, so you would need a large network of roads, helicopter pads, pipelines, and so on, connecting a bunch of different wells together that would crisscross and disrupt the habitat across the area.
Roger Herrera is with us also. He's the D.C. coordinator for Arctic Power in Washington, D.C. Roger's organization supports drilling in the Anwar. Roger, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
Maybe we should start with you. You just heard from Richard what he thinks will happen up there. Tell me a little bit about new drilling technology. I mean, we have ways now of minimizing damage to areas, right?
Yes. It's radically changed. The technology that's being used in the Arctic has undergone a transformation about equivalent to the old IBM computer that filled up six buildings to our laptop. And the same thing has happened in the oil industry, especially in the Arctic. Drilling rigs are quite different than the traditional ones that we're used to. They're smaller, they're lighter, they're much more specialized. They only use three or four people to operate them. Their impact on the environment is orders of magnitude less than it's ever been in the past. And, of course, what these rigs do is drill wells from a surface location which can trap a reservoir 5 miles away, perhaps 2 miles deep below the surface.
Horizontally.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. And so from one location, you can drain about 100 square miles of land. And obviously, this is much better than 500 individual wells filling up the tundra. So the footprint or the zone of influence of drilling has changed remarkably and is very benign and protective of the environment nowadays.
But in exploration, in order to get these 3D images of the resources below the surface of the Earth, as I understand it, for this latest 3D technology, you have to do a very closely driven grid. You're driving huge devices across the tundra, leaving tracks not very far apart in a huge grid. How do you deal with that kind of damage? People say that even 15 years after those vehicles have passed over the tundra, there's still destruction there. How do you deal with that?
No, not any longer. I mean, that's all changed. Instead of 50 pounds per square inch on the tires of a vehicle which drives on the solidly frozen tundra, by the way, this is only done in the middle of winter, now it's about 3 pounds per square inch. And certainly that compresses the snow, and the snow where the vehicle has been will take a few weeks longer to melt in the springtime because it has been slightly compressed. But there's absolutely no need, and in fact the evidence is there for everybody to see, to leave marks on the tundra nowadays. And the 3D seismic can be done, as I said, in the wintertime when the animals are out of the area, and it leaves no tracks behind. And the record it gives you is so detailed that it decreases the number of exploration wells which are needed to find the oil which is beneath the coastal plain.
So, Richard Kennelly, I know you're itching to get in here and talk about this new technology. It is true, isn't it, that new drilling technology is nowhere near as disruptive and destructive as the old drilling technology was?
There's no question that the industry has made advances, but we have to put this in perspective. It started out so horrendously damaging that you can make substantial improvements and still end up with something that has an unacceptable impact. Just 100 miles to the west of the refuge in current Prudhoe Bay operations, we have more than, on average, one significant reportable spill per day. We have air emissions that are greater than the city of Washington, D.C. These are smog as well as carbon dioxide, which is a global warming pollutant. And so, you know, even with a minimized impact, it's not fair to say that there is an insignificant impact. We're talking here about a refuge. A refuge is, by definition, a place to escape for shelter, for safety from threats. That comes from a Latin root meaning to flee or run away. Animals use this and depend on this habitat. And what we've found with Prudhoe Bay, and what we would find here if we open it up, is that animals will no longer be able to do the fairly sensitive things they do there, calving, cubbing, finding dens, escaping from predators, and so on. And that damage is incalculable, not to mention, I think, the broader damage of taking a unique place, one of the last wild places left in the United States, and putting wells and roads and air pollution and all that in the middle of it.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. This is a debate that's going to be going on in the U.S. Senate. There are competing bills in the Senate right now, and this is going to be a hot debate. It was started yesterday. There were a lot of people out on the Capitol steps talking about this. We want to hear from you, 1-800-423-8255. Right now, let's hear from Courtney. Courtney, welcome to The Connection.
Have you on the show there. I'd like to talk about the new presidency's tone of political disengagement. I think President Bush has shown that he's sort of taking a country towards unilateral foreign policy in terms of what's happening in Iraq, and then unilateral energy policy as well. We sort of sabotaged the Maastricht summit that happened just, you know, fairly recently. I think that if we can frame this discussion as well about a need for America to kind of wake up from a slumber, that we do need to address the fact that we produce 25% of climate global changing gases, and that can we sort of discuss a little bit the need for perhaps facing the fact that maybe we should be paying higher energy prices, and this is going to stimulate alternative energy.
I want to go to Roger Herrera with that question. Roger, you're backing this drilling up in Alaska. Do we really need this oil? Is this oil good for us?
Oh, well, if we want to be even more dependent on foreign oil, which is supplied to us by countries which are not very friendly to us, then we ignore the oil in Anwar. Of course we need it. I mean, we're on the cusp in this country of losing our traditional way of life, where we rely on transportation and expect it to be there, and electricity happens when we flick the switch. And as the Californians know today, they're beginning to worry about that. We need more energy in this country, and we need to produce it from areas which will be protected. I completely disagree with Richard's highly pessimistic description of the dangers and the damage that's been done in the Arctic. In fact, the Arctic oil fields are the cleanest oil fields in the world. And if you want to spill oil anywhere, you spill it in the Arctic, because that's the only place where it's cleaned up, and the cleanup is examined by the state of Alaska and the federal government. That certainly doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. or any other city where spills go down the drain into the Potomac River and into Chesapeake Bay. Now, with regard to what we should do with an energy policy, of course we've got to do everything we can, because there's no one solution. The coastal plain is not on its own the solution to our problem. But in fact, in the energy bill that Senator Murkowski has put forth, the money that would be forthcoming from production from the coastal plain, a lot of it would go to research into renewable energy forms. So we're using a finite resource to create an infinite resource.
So, Roger, we have a trade-off here. What the Bush administration is saying is, we'll develop solar power if you let us drill in the Arctic wildlife refuge. Richard, what do you think about that?
We need both, and we've got to have both, and we've got to have lots of conservation, too. We have to increase our automobile efficiency standards. Although, if we don't do all these things, we're going to put ourselves in hock to the Middle Eastern countries just a few years down the road.
Richard Kennelly, we've heard all this before. We have to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And then the oil prices went down to the point where we were all driving SUVs before you could bat an eyelash. Now we're hearing again, we've got to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And in exchange, we'll develop solar. What do you think about that?
Well, first, I don't think we've heard all this before. I've certainly never heard anyone say before that if you want to spill oil, you want to spill it in our last remaining pristine wilderness. I think that's outrageous. And I think, furthermore, we really need to step back and look at the numbers. We had a hint of this before. The United States currently consumes about one-fourth of the world's oil every year. Half of that is imported. We have control over less than 3% of the known oil reserves in the world, which is less than 200 billion gallons. At our current rate of consumption, which, by the way, is going up, we would run out of our own oil in less than 27 years. So this particular area has at most 16 billion barrels, and that is unlikely to be cost-effectively extractable. As we heard earlier, we're looking at a production rate of about 500,000 barrels a day. If we increase the fuel economy of our average car by 1 mile per gallon, that will save the same amount, 1 million gallons a day of oil. So the answer to Courtney's question, I think, which is a very well put one, is we don't have to raise the cost of fuel. We don't have to do that stuff. That may be a good idea, but it's really irrelevant to the debate here in the Arctic. This development will not help. It will not reduce the cost of oil. It will not significantly add to the production of oil. And instead, you know, this business about trading off oil for solar, the Bush plan proposes reducing the Department of Energy's budget by, coincidentally, precisely the amount of the renewable energy programs. We don't want to burn oil in order to develop solar. You can avoid burning the oil and develop solar.
1-800-423-8255. You can join our discussion on The Connection about ANWR, drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Alex is on the line. Alex, welcome to The Connection. Alex, you're not. Frank, you're on the line, I hope. Welcome to The Connection.
Hello, hello. I beat out Alex there. Alex wasn't paying attention. Sacred land. Debbie Miller, I got to tell you, right away, I could almost have written the scenario for her herself. But she used the term, I'll try to get right to the point here, John. By the way, John, very good point about the SUV and that whole discrepancy there. But she mentioned the term sacred land. This is sacred land. I would like to know where the sacred land is, where her point of view is on the separation of church and state. There is no sacrament up there. It's a piece of property that the United States people own. And this is, now I've got three quick points and I'll get out of your face.
Frank, we're not going to have time for your three points.
This is not an attack.
Stay on the line. We've got a break coming up, okay? You're listening to The Connection from WBUR in Boston and National Public Radio. We're talking with Richard Kennelly, the Energy Projects Director for Conservation Law Foundation, and Roger Herrera, the D.C. Coordinator for Arctic Power in Washington, D.C. I'm John McChesney.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental
Career Opportunities at Allaire.com.
You're listening to The Connection from WBUR, Boston, and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. We're talking about drilling for oil in Alaska. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests right now are Richard Kennelly. He's with the Energy Project. He's the Energy Projects Director at the Conservation Law Foundation, and Roger Herrera, who's the D.C. Coordinator for Arctic Power in Washington, D.C. And before we went into the break, we were talking with Frank, whom I had to cut off. Sorry I had to do that, Frank, but we're coming back to you now. But I want to remind you to be brief because we have a lot of callers. Frank, welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you, sir. This is not an attack on the caribou. Okay, the area required for drilling in that area of the world is probably about the size of the Back Bay of Boston. This is not only an opportunity for energy creation, but it's an opportunity for harmony between technology and nature. The technology is increasing, and I think there's a point here where it should be looked upon as an opportunity, not something we're trying to rip off the world for.
Richard Kennelly, will those caribou cuddle up to those drilling rigs and pipelines out there?
They won't. And, you know, to say that it's a small area that's being affected is like saying your heart is a small part of your body. If you impair the heart, you impair the whole system. And again, I think the thing is to put it into context. This is only 6 months' supply of oil. Is it worth it? Is it worth the risk, even if it's clean, even if you don't have as many spills as we have had? And I think it's a symbolic problem, too.
Roger Herrera, you're down there in Washington, and you're with Arctic Power, and you back this drilling. I live in California, where I'm paying usually about $1.85, $1.90 for a gallon of gas. And I have three refineries in the Bay Area, and the oil comes down from Alaska and gets refined there. Why am I paying such high prices for gasoline? Is that oil from Alaska going to stay in the United States and reduce our energy costs, or is it going to be shipped somewhere else after it's refined?
No, it stays in the United States, and one of your earlier callers suggested that all this oil is exported to Japan. Nothing could be further from the truth. There are no exports to Japan and haven't been for the last year at least. Legally, it's possible to export oil, but practically it's much better and has higher use leaving it in the United States of America. The price of oil, though, unfortunately, is controlled by OPEC nations. It's not controlled by the oil industry or American citizens. And this is why we've got to do something to hedge this control that they have. If they see us, as they have done for the past 8 years, doing nothing about our energy, they can jack the price up to a higher level as they want to, and we suffer the consequences. Our standard of living falls, our conveniences go away. This is one way of telling them that we are resolved to do something about our energy future. It's a very practical, beneficial way which will reverberate to our betterment throughout the country.
Let me interrupt for a minute, because I'm curious about this. OPEC, in the last price escalation we had about oil, it wasn't because OPEC was trying to take itself out on the United States. It wasn't doing what had happened earlier. It was actually a drop-off in production, which they were cooperatively increasing. In the earlier one, we had a blockage of production, and we went to war over it. We actually went to war and solved that problem. Why do we have to be so concerned about our foreign dependency on oil?
Well, because two-thirds of the world's oil resides in the Middle East, and so with the progress of time, more and more of our oil will have to come from that unstable political area. And that's why OPEC does have a control on the price. It might be in OPEC's best interest not to jack the price up too high at the present time. But in the future, as one of your callers said, the world production starts to decline. Undoubtedly, they will be in the driver's seat then. In fact, they're already there. And opening up ANWR, the coastal plain, gives us a much larger resource than Richard believes, because he doesn't accurately read the USGS resource estimates.
Well, let's put
it's
Richard,
certainly
let's
much put, more than a six-month supply. That nobody would be looking for it if it was only that amount.
Let's put Richard back in the discussion here. Richard Kennelly?
Thank you. I think I will agree with Roger that OPEC is already in charge. As he says, we already import half of our oil. They control at least two-thirds, perhaps as much as three-quarters of the oil.
You guys agree on this?
And so it is what I disagree with is that opening up the Arctic, even if it has the maximum amount of oil predicted, which is unlikely, would make any difference in that. We will not control the world prices of oil. John, you at your pump in California will not see a different price. It doesn't work that way. And so, you know, I think that the more important message we'll be sending to the world is not one of price, but instead that we are willing to sacrifice our last pristine public land for something like 6 months to maybe 3 years worth of oil when we're going around. President Bush has said climate change is an important problem. This is not the way to address climate change.
I can see that this is going to be a genuinely hot debate down there in Washington. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Larry is on the line. He's from Stockholm, New York. Hi, Larry. Thanks for calling us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. This seems like kind of typical irrational behavior of a junkie. Oil is obviously a dead end, both in supply and in global warming. You know, we're killing the planet in the process. But unlike a junkie, though, we have this huge surplus. Why don't we, instead of talking about a tax cut, take that surplus and use it to create alternative energies instead of constantly going for more hair of the dog, sort of, you know? I mean, this seems like an incredible opportunity with this surplus we have now to solve the problem and hopefully allow life to continue on the planet.
Roger, I know what Richard would say in answer to that, so I'm going to go down to Roger. Roger, do you think it would be a good idea to develop alternative energy sources with the surplus that we have instead of doing a tax cut so we wouldn't be so dependent on foreign oil?
Oh, of course it would be a good idea. We have to do that. I mean, we've got to try everything we can, but let's look at some real realities of it. You know, the increased electricity that we will use in this country between today and the year 2010 is something like 214 gigawatts. Now, if we generated that through solar power and wind farms, we would be covering up something like 9.6 million acres of land. That's about a tenth of California. Now, does that have environmental impact? I would suggest that it would. Even the Sierra Club calls wind farms Cuisinarts of the air and things like that. They all have problems. However, by all means, let's put money, which in fact the energy bill does, into renewable energy. But you're not going to solve the problem either with conservation or renewable energy. You have to use the traditional forms of energy as well.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Benjamin is on the line. Welcome to The Connection, Benjamin.
Yeah, thank you very much, John. What I want to say is that the idea behind this oil drilling is very, very selfish. It's selfish motive because it's not going to solve any problem. And again, I would like to make the point that nobody actually know what the repercussions of all this drilling will be in the near future. We cannot just say in a very short time that this is what the repercussion is going to be. Nobody really knows. And again, I'm also going to make a point that drill, as long as we have a place to drill, alternative energy will never be addressed because you have all these powerful oil moguls. And let's not forget that George Bush comes from a state that depends entirely on oil as its main source of revenue, and it's going to be going for that.
Well, not anymore. Not that much oil coming out of Texas these days as there used to be. But he did come from the oil patch, and I'm sure that has some influence on the way he thinks. Richard Kennelly, I wanted to come back to you because you've been edging up toward the microphone there, as if you wanted to jump into the conversation. What do you want to throw in there?
Sure. A couple things. First of all, in order to solve the problems, as the caller said, we are behaving something like a junkie, and opening up the Arctic Refuge is essentially giving one more fix or another fix before starting the treatment program. The treatment program is inevitable. We will someday run out of oil, and long before then, we'll be paying very high prices in terms of political instability as well as the cost. And so now is the time to do things that are cost-effective. And I'm not talking about tightening the belt. Again, if you just maintain your car better, put on new tires, buy a car that gets just 1 or 2 or 3 miles per gallon better fuel, not only will you save several hundred dollars a year in gas costs, but you'll be making a big dent in climate change, and you will eliminate the need to extract any oil from the Arctic Refuge.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peter's on the line. Welcome to The Connection, Peter.
Hi. I know the conversation has shifted a little bit, but I'd like to get back to the technical aspects of actually the removal of the oil from the ground. I know that the fellow from the Arctic Power was talking about directional drilling. Now that may work for getting a hole in the ground, but you still got to get the heavy crude out. And I understand the gas will flow out under pressure, but the crude oil is too dense to flow out, so you need to put something in the ground to pump it out. And I deal actually in the water supply industry up here in Boston, but actually the technology pumping oil is not my purview. But I wonder if you could discuss that.
Roger Herrera, why don't you have a go at that one?
Interestingly, all the oil that's produced from the North Slope of Alaska, which has been between 20 and 25% of our domestic production over the last 20 years or so, comes out of the ground with natural pressure. It is not pumped out. And certainly the expectation is, and it's a good geological expectation, that the same would prevail with oil beneath the coastal plain. So that aspect of the of subsurface well technology simply doesn't come into play in Alaska. We've got natural conditions which favor the easy extraction of the oil, and it wouldn't be any different than existing production. It would all go into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, come down the West Coast, go into American double-hull tankers, and be delivered to markets in Washington, Oregon, California, and elsewhere.
And there's no guarantee that we won't have another Exxon Valdez, right, Roger?
No, there's no guarantee either. There's an even smaller guarantee with regard to the foreign tankers, which are, of course, multiplying in number because of our increased dependency on foreign oil. Those are non-U.S. Ships. They are not controlled by the Coast Guard and so on. And the converse is the brand-new, state-of-the-art American ships, which, of course, have the benefit of learning from the Exxon Valdez spill and a determination never to repeat it.
800-423-8255. Join us on The Connection. Seth, you're on the line from Peterborough, New Hampshire.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to make the point that with America being such a major player in the world right now, why not set an example, just to jump back a few minutes ago to alternative energy, why not set an example for the world and break free of sort of enslavement that we are under from the petroleum industry? Why don't we maybe go back to something like we had under Carter, where there was a 40% tax break for people that would use solar energy in the construction of their homes, sort of turn it back on an individual basis and rely upon the American people to start to make the correct choices. And, you know, people are always talking about, you know, and one of your callers mentioned earlier, I mean, one of your guests mentioned earlier, sorry, you know, that, well, let us drill a little bit in the Alaskan refuge, and then maybe we'll go ahead and use alternative energy. Why not start the ball rolling the other way and make an example for the world?
Thanks for your call. Richard, I'm going to give you, Richard Kennelly, I'm going to give you one last shot at this. We're short on time, so keep it short.
Okay, thank you. The bottom line is this is a unique, pristine environment. It doesn't have enough oil to make a difference for our price or our independence. The way to go for independence is to develop natural, renewable resources and conservation.
Roger Herrera down in Washington. Is this going to happen in Senate? You're going to win down there?
Yes, we will, because I think increasingly people will realize that their energy future is very precarious. And it is not selfish to use our natural resources responsibly. The coastal plain was set aside for its oil and gas potential, and this is the decision Congress has to make. And Alaskans are hugely in favor of that, and they have no intention of messing up their backyard.
You've been listening to The Connection on WBUR Boston National Public Radio. We've been talking about drilling for oil in Alaska, and I want to thank all of our guests, Debbie Miller, who was on earlier, from up in Fairbanks, and Lon Sensala, who's the mayor of Katovic, who's an island off of the coast, a village on the island off of the coast of Alaska. Richard Kennelly, who's here in the studio with us, he's the Energy Projects Director at the Conservation Law Foundation in Boston, and Roger Herrera down in Washington, he's the D.C. Coordinator for Arctic Power in Washington, D.C. I'm John McChesney. Thanks for listening to The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.